It is only natural to want to be noticed. It's only natural when you want, when you do something, to expect people to sort of recognize that, to reward you for that, award you for that. Especially if you really have sacrificed something, given up something, you just expect people to notice, to say something, do something. And it's just a natural side to that. Of course, as we get a little bit older, sometimes we may look back on something in our lives and think, you know, it may be a good thing I didn't get recognized. Not that I did something bad, but sometimes just to get to know ourselves a little better, we look back and think, you know, if I had gotten recognition for this or for that, maybe it would have caused me undue pride. Or maybe because I got recognized for this or awarded for this, I wouldn't have worked as hard in the future because I've rested my laurels because of that. In Mark chapter 10, almost said John chapter 10. What book have we been in for a year and a half? In Mark chapter 10, the text we read earlier, I hope you notice that the narrative continues on with Jesus telling his apostles on the way to Jerusalem, here is exactly what's going to happen. But then two of the apostles, James and John, come near to Jesus. Matthew chapter 20, by the way, will supplement the fact that, well, their mother's with them. And in fact, it's the mother of Jesus that will actually make the request we'll talk about in a few moments. But these two apostles, James and John, ask something that has to do with greatness. And the conversation that goes back and forth in these verses is one that is very interesting and very important, of course, because of the people who are talking and because of the setting coming nearer to the cross. But what Jesus is going to do is turn this conversation into one that, of course, is for those who are there. We know later that it's not just James and John, but all the apostles are there. But then by way of application, Jesus is going to give a landmark teaching for anyone who would be a follower of His. We're going to think about this text this morning under three observations. Number one, there is the request. James and John, they're pretty audacious people, aren't they? Don't you just love... And by the way, again, Matthew 20 tells us their mother's actually the one who makes the request. Now, next week's Mother's Day. I'm not preaching that text for Mother's Day. There ain't no way. I may not be a great preacher. I'm smarter than that. But they make a very audacious request. Do for us whatever we ask you. Wow. Now, you've probably had someone come to you before and say, would you do me a favor? And if you didn't know the setting of someone saying that, you might kind of give a sort of half response to it. Like, I will if I can, right? Or something like that. But can you imagine not sort of asking for a favor, but looking at Jesus and saying, I want you to do for me whatever I ask, whatever we ask. Jesus' response is interesting. When he basically says, what do you want? What do you want me to do for you? Now, it's not that Jesus needed the information. Of course, Jesus knows everything. He knows the thoughts of people. He knows what they're going to say before they say it. So he's not asking this for information. He's asking this for them to actually vocalize what's on their mind, I believe, so that the other apostles who are there will hear the request that's being made. But whatever the reason, Jesus has them actually vocalize the request. And the request is one that's very, very audacious. We want you to let us sit, one on your right hand and one on your left, in your glory. Again, Matthew's account will supplement the fact for us that by His glory, what they're talking about is His kingdom. That request, then, really shows a couple of misconceptions. One of which we've mentioned a few times going through Mark, and it's going to become one that becomes a very important thing, and that is their misconception about the nature of the kingdom itself. And they're asking something about sitting on thrones and having this place of prominence in the kingdom. What they're speaking about here is an earthly concept, a material concept of the kingdom. In a spiritual kingdom, there's just not such a thing. There's just not such a thing as these same types of places of prominence and all of that. But that's still their mindset. Now, sometimes we can get sort of upset with the apostles. How could they not get this? But let's just be honest. We probably wouldn't have either. We know the full revelation. We have the rest of the story. And so we grasp the kingdom concept. They didn't. But more what they're confused about is where the conversation will continue. And that is the nature of true greatness. You see, what James and John are requesting here is an earthly sign of greatness. Be near the king. Sit up front. Be on a throne. Have those kinds of connections. Get a reward for what you've done. In earthly kingdoms, we grasp that concept. Even though we don't live in a physical earthly kingdom, we've seen enough movies to get the concept. We get the idea of what it means to be rewarded or awarded even in that type of government system. Jesus wasn't talking about an earthly kingdom. And when he talked about greatness, that's not the kind of thing he was talking about. But that's the request they make. They make something about greatness, something about an earthly kingdom. Now before we move on, let me at least give James and John at least a tiny bit of credit. You think, wait, what? Here's what I mean. Sometimes because of texts like this, sometimes because of the fact that we know we don't no longer live in the age of miracles, we're afraid to ask God for big things. Now, James and John were misguided. They were confused. And their motivation probably wasn't the best either. And Jesus is going to point that out as this text goes along. But at least they had the mindset that something great could be asked of Jesus. Do we still believe that our God is able to do far more abundantly than anything we ask or think? And if we do, should we not pray like it? Yes, in humility. And yes, always seeking that His will be done. But if He can do bigger things than even we can imagine, we should be asking for some pretty large things at times. The problem with James and John's request is not that it was a big deal. It was the motivation behind it that made it wrong. And that leads, number two, to the responses. This conversation that goes back and forth. Jesus begins the conversation looking back at them. And he talks to them about greatness, yeah, but I love that he shuts their water off. You don't know what you're asking. Wow. I wonder what their mother's face looks like when Jesus said, I wonder what James and John's face looked like. But you don't know what you're asking. And then Jesus seemingly changes the conversation completely. Now he hasn't. He's going to stay on point, but it seems as if Jesus has changed the conversation when he asks a couple of questions. But those couple of questions really are parallel. See, here's what I mean. He asks this question about a cup, and he asks this question about baptism, and it's confusing to us because we don't talk that way. But he's really asking the same question twice. The Jews very often would speak in parallels. In other words, they would say something and then restate it in different words for emphasis. That's what Jesus is doing here. When he talks about a cup, drinking from a cup, he's talking about wrath, he's talking about suffering, he's talking about judgment. We know that terminology probably most famously from when Jesus prays in the Garden of Gethsemane, "Let this cup pass from me." But that wasn't the first time that terminology was used. Isaiah used it. And many ancient cultures, by the way, used the same terminology to talk about things like judgment and suffering and wrath and all those sorts of things. There are some who suggest that the reason for that in many ancient cultures, frankly, was because a long, 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 long time ago, if you wanted to execute somebody, you had them drink poison. And so then that became a symbol of the judgment or the wrath or the suffering inflicted upon someone. But then this picture about baptism seems very strange to us because when we think about baptism, we narrow it down to just that one thing, being baptized in water for the remission of sins. That's not what Jesus is talking about. The word baptism just means an immersion in something. Jesus is talking about being immersed in suffering. He had been baptized, not for the forgiveness of sins, to fulfill all righteousness, a long time ago at this point in time. But he's talking here about something ongoing, present tense and ongoing. Can you be baptized with the baptism that I am baptized with? No, it's the suffering. Can you do that? Now, I think it's interesting that their response is, we can or we are able. There are a few scholars who suggest that James and John just responded without thinking. Yeah, of course we can. I'm not sure that's the case. Because of Jesus' response to them, he doesn't cut them off and say you're wrong or you're not thinking or anything along those lines. Instead, when Jesus responds to them, when they say that we're able, well, what he really does is tells them they're right and they're wrong. They're right in that, yeah, they can suffer. And in fact, by way of prophecy, Jesus says they will. They will drink a cup, as it were. They will be baptized, immersed in suffering for their faith. Did that happen or not? Yes, it did. To these two individuals. James becomes the first apostle, not the first person, but the first apostle who is put to death for faith. Acts chapter 12 and verse 2 tells us that Herod Agrippa had him put to death. And the reason was because of his faith. John wasn't executed for his faith. In fact, he's the last living apostle. So was Jesus wrong? Oh no. Because when you read the last book of the Bible, Revelation, penned by this man, he writes it from an island, but he's not on vacation. He's on that island in exile for the testimony of Jesus Christ. In other words, he is exiled because of his faith. It may have happened at different times in their lives. It may have happened in different manners. But both James and John, well, they were right. They could drink the cup. They could be baptized with suffering, and Jesus says you would. But then Jesus begins to turn the conversation back and tells them, but you're also wrong. You're also wrong about something. And that is this whole thing about positions in the kingdom. Jesus even says here, it's not mine to grant. It's not mine to grant who sits on the right hand or the left hand. But instead it's for those who have prepared themselves. Matthew will supplement the fact that Jesus says, prepared for it by my Father. Which, by the way, shows a subtle reminder of the humility of Jesus to the plan of God. They continue to come back to the idea about greatness, position, self-glorification, and Jesus continues to say that's not right. And don't you love the final little response here that the other apostles are mad at James and John? Now I wonder why. I've got a reason on the screen. I've got a couple of possibilities that both are basically the same thing. Maybe they had wanted to ask the same question, and they're mad at James and John, not only for asking the question, but for getting their mommy to do it. Or the other possibility is, they're kind of upset at James and John because they hadn't thought to ask the question, and James and John have thought of a better question. Look, remember, it's Peter, not that long ago, who had said, we've left everything to follow you. James and John could have said much the same thing. We've left a lot of stuff behind to follow you. So now they're going to get these exalted places. They're going to get the right hand, the left hand in glory in the kingdom. And I don't like that they asked the question. And in a moment that could have been very awkward, Jesus turns it around to a cornerstone moment and talks about the ruling. And he begins with something that they knew. He talks about earthly rulers. And I don't think he means every last one of them. He's speaking in generalities. But he talks about how rulers often lord their position over their people. If you mark in your Bible, by the way, beside that word over, they rule it over, you might want to actually write the word down. Because what Jesus literally said was, they rule down on the people under their charge. They push people down or to make themselves look better. That's the word picture Jesus is drawing. And then he changes it completely around to the apostles and says, but that's not the way it's going to be with you. Now think for a moment again to whom this was said. These are the apostles. These are the ones who were handpicked. Dare I say they were chosen. These are the ones who were handpicked for this particular role. Were they important? Yes. They were able to do some amazing things. They had already been able to perform miracles, and they would continue to be able to do that. They had already heard Jesus preach and teach countless times, and that would continue for the time coming up to Jerusalem and after Jesus was raised from the dead. They had been closest to him of anyone, and it had no telling how many private conversations, many of which we don't even have in Scripture. Can you imagine just the access they had, the questions they could have asked, the conversations they would have had? They were very important people. And they will be. They would be people of great importance within the early church. And even today, even though they're not alive, we still look back on the preachings and the writings of Peter. We still are reminded of the writings of Paul, who became an apostle later. And we're reminded of the Acts of the Apostles and how they spread the gospel throughout the world. But Jesus is telling them, whatever your position is, it's not to be used because you are something special. It's not to be used so that you can push other people down. And to drive that point home, Jesus gives both a principle and an example. The principle is, you're going to be a servant of all. Don't leave off that phrase, of all. Fitting, by the way, this morning we're doing this lesson, this is totally coincidence, because the word servant here is deacon. Not the official role, as it were, we saw these nine men earlier, but the idea of literally a table servant. You're going to do that for all. And who's the example of that? Jesus himself. There are some who suggest that Mark 10, verse 45 is the key verse of the entire Gospel of Mark. If it's not, it's for sure on a short list. The Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve, and to give his life as a ransom for many. He had a position, the Son of Man. But he came, and he didn't come so that he could then sit on a throne and have people pour out and shower him with gifts and talk about how wonderful he is as he just barks down in orders and tells people, you're horrible, I'm great. No, no. Instead, he came to serve. And not just to give, and not just to give his life, and not just to give his life for many, to give his life as a ransom for many. I'm going to serve to the level that I'm going to give my life to buy people back from what caused me to have the suffering. Now, we read that account, and it's fairly easy to understand. I probably haven't said anything thus far you don't already know. But applying this passage is very practical. But practical ain't easy. You see, often when we apply sermons, here's what I'll give you the preacher trick. We've got some preachers in the room. If you can't think of an application for a sermon, here's the easy one. Study your Bible and pray more. That's the application to like 85% of sermons, because you really can't think of much else to say, and after all, that's a pretty good application, right? Study your Bible more, pray more. That's good. But when you really take a text like this one and really think, what does this mean? It's practical, yes, but it's certainly not easy. And here's why. James and John wanted something great in the kingdom. If you're a Christian, you're in the kingdom. Matthew chapter 16. And I sure would like people to notice me in the kingdom. I sure would like people to know what I do. But if I'm going to be like the one who's the head of that kingdom, I'm going to be a table servant to all. And not so much worry about the recognition. Think about that body concept that Paul would write about, 1 Corinthians 12 and elsewhere. We use that illustration a lot, that he compares the church to a body and how every part of a body is important. And we grasp that. Sometimes we notice certain parts of our bodies more. A day like this, a beautiful sunny day, we notice our eyes more because we can see, or maybe we hear the birds in the morning and our ears remind us of that. We go to a symphony, remind of that, or flowers are blooming and, okay, our sinuses. No, and we're reminded of all the parts of our bodies. And all, but we also realize when we're not feeling well that something, maybe something we can't even see, just isn't right. And we just didn't think of that part of our body at all. But now that part of our body becomes pretty important. And what Paul is trying to remind us of is every part of the body is absolutely vital. And we all know we have different talents, we have different abilities, we have different opportunities, we have different relationships and circumstances, but every part of it is important. And then it comes time to deal with the work of the church. And there are talents I have, talents I don't have. There are talents you don't have. I've said before, you do not want me in charge of crafts at Vacation Bible School. You don't want that. Either the crafts are going to be terrible or the kids are going to die. That's pretty much the two outcomes. It's not going to be pretty. But then what would happen if we get to Vacation Bible School and for some strange reason all the craft people are sick and Noah's high on cough medicine or something and says, Adam, I want you to be in charge of crafts at Vacation Bible School. You know what my response better not be? I'm the preacher. I don't do that kind of work. No. If they're the worst crafts ever done, I'm going to serve my Lord. When it's time for a fellowship meal or something and we're through and people are starting to wipe off tables, we may be doing 1,000 different things, and I may or may not wipe off a table, but even if I don't, it better never be because I think that's beneath me to go wipe off a table and clean up the fellowship. I read the emails every day and someone's in the hospital and maybe I'm out of town. Maybe I'm not even in town. I can't go by and visit or something. But I read that email. Yeah, I could send them a text, but nobody's going to know that I did that. Well, I want their recognition. I want people to know. But take it outside the building. Take it outside the church family. Who are we to serve? As you have opportunity, do good to all. Especially to those who are the household of faith. We like to jump to that. But as you have opportunity, do good to all. What about if it's somebody I could help, but this is 2024, it's an election year, and they vote very differently than I do, and frankly, they're annoying about it. Or I could go help them, I could go help that family, but I've been over there before, and they don't keep their house very clean. Frankly, it smells terrible. Or, I know their past. I don't know them well, but I've heard plenty of stories about their past. I know the kind of person they were. Or, I know what they've done to me in my past. And now I've got an opportunity to help them. Who did Jesus serve? He served centurions, Romans, Jews, Jewish leaders who would put him to death. He served the sick, the poor. Frankly, he served the dead, and we're specifically told that the dead person, Lazarus, would not smell good because he'd been dead 4 days. Did Jesus help people with checkered pasts? Oh yeah. Out of whom had come 7 demons? Did Jesus help those who had hurt him? Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do. If the Son of Man would do that, then who do I think that I am? To not do anything for anyone to His glory. He did not come to be served. He came to serve. If I may change the verse slightly, but not the meaning at all. To be my ransom. See why I say this is a practical conclusion, but it's not easy? Because if I'm going to be like the one whose name I claim to wear, then there is no work beneath me. None. And it frankly does not matter who notices. Because even a cup of water given in His name is noticed in glory. And if I may be even more frank than that, I don't care if I sit on a throne in the kingdom. I just want to be with my Lord. That's it. If you need to come to Him this morning or return in humble faithfulness again, will you come? I'll be standing soon to encourage you.